Hello and welcome to the week three Q&A session. So today I've got three questions that I want to address, and these three questions are questions that have come up a couple of times for various people, so I thought it'd be useful to say something about them. So the first one is, I've been diligently averaging about 8 to 10 gutikas a day. Recently, it feels as if I'm going to bed with a 1,000-watt bulb and I'm having a hard time falling asleep. Although I wake up in the morning feeling awake, I'm not sure the lack of sleep is a sustainable practice. Is there any recommendations in this situation? Is a changing sleep pattern part of progressing with shamatha? Okay, just a few things to say here. First, of course, is that the more we practice shamatha, of course, the more we develop a calm, clear, and focused mind, you often find that the amount of sleep you need could reduce because that shamatha practice is soothing the mind. And so you'll find that now, of course, if we're very agitated, disturbed state of mind throughout the day, then for the mind to recover from that, then we tend to need quite a lot of sleep. But the more we practice shamatha, you may find, in fact, you'll need less sleep. Particularly if you're doing a retreat, an intensive retreat, you may find that you quite substantially need less sleep due to the practice. So that's one point. But here, of course, the question is talking about having a hard time falling asleep. So I think this really points to the fact that we really need to have relaxation as the basis. You know, we talk about cultivating the three qualities of relaxation, stability, and clarity in the shamatha practice. And one analogy that's often used for the relationship of these three qualities in the shamatha practice is that relaxation is like the roots of the tree. So we first need to, of course, have deep roots in a tree to hold the tree. So similarly, we need to dig deep roots of relaxation to hold the trunk of stability. And then we need a strong trunk of stability to be able to support the branches of clarity. So the stronger the roots of relaxation, the stronger the trunk of stability can be, the higher the branches of clarity can grow. Of course, if we don't sink very strong roots of relaxation and we go for a lot of high branches of clarity, I think the whole tree of shamatha is going to collapse, is going to fall over, as we see. You know, there's a little bit of a puff of wind and the tree falls over because it doesn't have very deep roots. So therefore, we need to be very careful if we're starting to get clarity, and the person here talks about that they're really going to bed with a 1,000-watt bulb. So they've got a lot of clarity here, but it's not really based on relaxation. It's coming at a cost of relaxation. So the mind is not very relaxed, thereby having a hard time falling asleep. So another analogy that Alan uses regarding these three qualities of relaxation, stability, clarity is like a pyramid. Like the base of the pyramid is relaxation. The middle part is then the stability, and the top part of the pyramid, which is very sharp, of course, is the clarity. So if you want that clarity, then we need to have a broad, strong base of relaxation. So therefore, what I'd recommend is to really develop more and more and more the relaxation, and don't develop the clarity at the cost of either stability or relaxation. Otherwise, our mind is going to be very energized. It's going to become quite agitated. And similarly, you'll find for Vipassana practices, because this sharp edge of clarity is, of course, what we use in Vipassana practice. And thereby, again, if we don't have that strong basis in relaxation and we do a lot of Vipassana, then our mind will get very worked up, we get very hyper. So therefore, also what I'd recommend is that not to do these sort of high energizing type of meditations before we go to bed, for example, Vipassana practices and so forth. Also, of course, to help to go to sleep, we can use the Shavasana posture. So maybe as the last Gatika of the day, we can lie in bed in the Shavasana posture, and then we can do a Shamatha practice of simply observing the sensations of the breath, particularly down in the body, in the abdomen region, not at the nostrils. And then just really on every out-breath, emphasizing relaxation, relaxing the body, relaxing the mind. And then do that as long as you can maintain some alertness. And then when you see that you start to get very drowsy, then just mentally note that your practice has come to an end, and then move out of that posture into whatever posture you use for sleep. So therefore, only use the Shavasana posture for meditation, and then we can meditate quite well in a very relaxed way with the Shavasana posture, and also use it as a transition to sleep. And then, of course, also, if you find that in the middle of the night you wake up and you find it difficult to get back to sleep, then, of course, not going to be very helpful to get frustrated or worried about not getting enough sleep, but rather, again, same. Shavasana posture, and use that opportunity to do mindfulness, full body, noticing sensations of the breath, and just emphasizing relaxation, relaxation, relaxation. And then you'll find you probably get drowsy and you can fall asleep. And even if you don't, simply doing that is really getting a lot of benefits of the sleep. So even if you're there for 1 or 2 hours doing this, you know, 2 hours of doing this may be equivalent to actually 1 hour of sleep. So you're getting rest and practice as well. So that's something we can do if we wake up in the middle of the night and can't get back to sleep. No point, again, getting frustrated or upset. So that's the first question. Again, just being careful that we don't develop clarity at the expense of relaxation, really working on relaxation. And that'll be very helpful. Second question here is a little about the meditating with the eyes open. So the person says, second part of their question was, again, on open eyes, the practice is more intense but also fatiguing. I would say exhausting if I sit more than 1 hour. Alan invites us to leave the eyes open at the beginning of settling the mind in its natural state practice. What about visualizations? So, of course, the general recommendation for settling the mind in its natural state and also the awareness of awareness practice is to have the eyes open. In other practices, such as visualization practice or observing the breath, then it's optional. So for those practices, you could follow the general recommendation, which is to have the eyes slightly open. Or if you find that you're the sort of person that gets easily agitated, even with eyes slightly open, maybe having them lightly closed. Or if you're the sort of person who naturally tends to be more dull than agitated, then definitely it's probably a good idea to have the eyes open, not to have them closed, otherwise just going to slip into dullness. So remember a number of reasons to have the eyes open in settling the mind and the awareness of awareness practice. One, of course, is it really helps to break down this false sense of inner and outer, this sense of duality. Because with the eyes closed, we really have a sense that there's a me in here and a world out there. Whereas if we have the eyes open, this false sense of inner and outer starts to break down. And of course, this is what we're going to try to realize in the Vipassana nature of the mind practices. Also, of course, with the eyes open, improve clarity. Eyes closed, much easier to drift into dullness. Also, of course, with eyes closed, much easier to drift into the past and the future. With the eyes open, it really helps us to be more locked into the present moment. And of course, the other benefit is in this settling the mind in its natural state or awareness practice, if we're practicing, we're meditating with the eyes open in these practices, then it's going to be much easier to transition to daily life. Because also in daily life, of course, it would be very good to be able to rest in the stillness of awareness while observing thoughts and emotions and not getting caught up in them. But if we're only used to doing that with eyes closed in meditation, then in daily life, when generally our eyes are open, it's not going to be as easy to observe thoughts and emotions or rest in the stillness of awareness. So therefore, if we meditate with eyes open in these practices, much easier to bring those practices into daily life as well. If you're not used to meditating with eyes open, then it could take a little bit of time to get used to it. So I would simply recommend just be patient there and stay relaxed and don't push or try harder. So here the person asks the question that they say that the practice is more intense but also fatiguing and they get exhausted doing this practice. So again, what we want to do with the eyes open is we can either have them partially open or naturally open. But we're not straining the eyes in any way. So keep them soft and relaxed so you can monitor the area around the eyes regularly. If you notice any tension around the eyes, just release that, release it. So we're not trying to deliberately keep the eyes open without blinking. So blink as often as you need. And of course, what we don't want to do is try to deliberately unfocus them because that's going to strain the eyes as well. Simply vacantly resting our gaze in the space in front of us. And what also can be helpful, particularly when we're beginning to do this practice, where there can be a tendency for our eyes to dominate and that our visual field takes over and we start looking around a lot, is to meditate in a dark room so there's nothing to catch your attention, or at least meditate with the eyes open in front of a blank wall so there's nothing to attract your attention, a little bit the sort of the Zen approach. Or as I mentioned in one of the earlier Q&A sessions, is you can try one of these mind folds, these blindfolds specifically developed for meditation purposes. And so then, of course, you can keep your eyes open with this mind fold and it'll be completely dark. So I recommend trying those as well. Just before I move on to the third question, then I'd just like to reiterate some points about the eyes in this practice. First off, I'd like to read from Alan Wallace's book here, Attention Revolution, when he talks about these keeping the eyes open in the practice. The first section is on page 86, and it says, "Let your gaze be vacant." So that's the quote from the text. And then Alan's commentary is, "In this practice," and here he's talking about the settling the mind in its natural state, "it is important that your eyes are open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you. If you have not meditated with your eyes open, you may find this uncomfortable, but I encourage you to get used to it. Blink as often as you like and don't strain your eyes in any way. Let them be as relaxed as if you were daydreaming with your eyes open. By leaving the eyes open, while focusing your attention on the domain of mental events, the artificial barrier between inner and outer begins to dissolve. Especially in our materialist society, we have gotten used to the idea that our thoughts and all other mental events are inside our heads. But this has never been demonstrated scientifically. All that is known in this regard is that mental events are correlated with neural events, but that doesn't necessarily mean they are located in the same place. Even without this materialist assumption that the mind is nothing more than a function of the brain, we naturally have a sense that we are looking out on the world from behind our eyes. But this sense of an independent subject or ego inside the head is an illusion. There is no scientific support for such a belief. And when it is inspected through rigorous contemplative inquiry, this autonomous thinker and observer inside the head is nowhere to be found. In this practice, by leaving your eyes open, but by directing your attention to the mind, this conceptually superimposed demarcation between inner and outer begins to erode. You begin to recognize that your thoughts are not occurring in here in your head, nor are they occurring out there in space. This practice challenges the existence of an absolutely objective space of the physical senses that is absolutely separate from the subjective space of the mind. You are now on the path to realizing the meaning of non-duality. And then one other thing I'd like to talk about here is about the positioning of the eyes. And here he also talks about this in his book, and this is on page 133, so let's have a look at that. And here he's in the context, it's the context of awareness practice, and he's quoting Padmasambhava. So Padmasambhava says the following: cast your gaze downwards, gently release your mind, and without having anything on which to meditate, gently release both your body and mind into their natural state. Having nothing on which to meditate, and without any modification or adulteration, rest your attention simply, without wavering, in its own natural state, its natural limpidity, its own character, just as it is. Remain in that state of luminosity and rest your mind so that it is loose and free. Alternate between observing that which is concentrating inwardly and that which is releasing. If you think it is the mind, ask, who is it that releases the mind and concentrates the mind? Steadily observe yourself, then release again. By so doing, fine stability will arise and you may even identify pristine awareness. So here he's talking about if our mind is very agitated and tense and caught up in distraction, then we can cast our gaze downwards, meaning to lower your gaze and then release your awareness. And then also in this section he talks about doing a little bit of Vipassana by asking questions about who is it that's doing this. So this, of course, is moving into Vipassana, but this can also help improve the shamatha, and he said here you can even maybe identify pristine awareness. And then in the next paragraph he says, if you become muddled and unmindful, you have slipped into laxity or dimness. So clear up this problem, arouse your awareness and shift your gaze. Shift your gaze here means elevate your gaze if you find yourself becoming dull, laxity is setting in. If you become distracted and excited, it is important that you lower your gaze and release your awareness. So what we could see there is in terms of the eyes, then we can adjust the level of our gaze depending on whether we're slipping into dullness or getting agitated and distracted. So we can adjust the gaze accordingly. And then the third question is, and there are a number of questions here about the sadhana practice, the late-born Vajra sadhana practice. Now, some of you, of course, haven't got the empowerment, but for those of you who have the empowerment and are doing this practice, then there's a question here, and then I want to comment a little bit. The person says, I understand that the deity has to be visualized in front of me, but what about the identification with the deity? Should I identify with the visualization I created in front of me? Should I project the identification of myself onto the image in front of me, or absorb the image in myself in the place where I sit? So two things. The late-born Vajra practice, of course, we are arising as the deity. Of course, there are other practices where we visualize, like in the Shower of Blessings, we visualize the deity in front of us and then visualize receiving blessings from the deity. So, but here in the late-born Vajra practice, of course, we are arising as the deity. But here, what's very important, and maybe if you're just looking at the short sadhana, it's not so obvious. At the beginning of the short sadhana, There is, in brackets, the preliminaries, which talks about begin with taking refuge and cultivating bodhicitta. And then there is a capital letter A, A. So, of course, this is the syllable A. So that syllable A is the signal for us to dissolve into emptiness. Because we need to arise as the deity from emptiness. Because if we don't do this and we start by our normal sense of me, and then at the beginning we're trying to simply pretend to be the deity, then we're just replacing one delusion with another delusion. Instead of grasping onto this body and mind as me, we'll simply be grasping onto the deity as me. We shouldn't think, I am pretending to be the deity. This, then we've completely missed the point. So therefore, when we see that at the beginning of the sadhana, then we are to dissolve ourselves into emptiness. If we don't have any real understanding or experience of emptiness, then at least we can try to approximate that by resting in awareness. So simply rest in the stillness of awareness, releasing all appearances. And you may even helpful here to try that merging mind with space, is just release everything into space. And at least then our grasping onto this body and mind will be hopefully a little bit reduced. Of course, ideally the best would be to dissolve into emptiness. But then from this state of either state of emptiness, for at least sort of in this spacious open state where we're not identifying with this body and mind, then arise as the deity. And another problem, this was also related to somewhere else in the question, was if we don't do this and we simply are pretending to be the deity, then we're transferring our identity to the deity, then we have, of course, still a sense of me being a male or a female or so forth. And then it can become a little bit awkward when we are visualizing ourselves as a deity that is a different gender, or of course in this case we're visualizing the deity with consort. Then it gets a little bit awkward. If we do dissolving into emptiness and then we arise as the deity, then I think this awkwardness won't really be there. And in some sadhanas, instead of that at the beginning of the sadhana, as Alan mentioned a number of times, we have a longer mantra, this Om Svabhava Shuddha Sarva Dharma Svabhava Shuddho Ham. So this also can be useful. So Svabhava there, of course, means nature, Shuddha, pure, Sarva, all, Dharma, phenomena. So Om Svabhava Shuddha Sarva Dharma means all phenomena are by nature pure. And then the second part of the mantra is Svabhava Shuddho Ham. So nature, pure, I am. So I am that pure nature. I am that pure nature. So that can also be very helpful. And then often people also talk about the fact that they're not good at visualizing, you know. In these deity practices, there are these two aspects, what's called divine pride and clear appearance. So the divine pride of being the deity and then the clear appearance of the deity. Of those two, the first is more important, to actually have the divine pride of being the deity. So again, to really develop that, and to develop that again by starting dissolving into emptiness and then arising out of emptiness as the deity. Because if we're simply switching this identity with the identity of the deity, then we're not really having this divine pride. We need to be coming out of emptiness to really develop that. And then the clear appearance will come over time. So don't get too upset or worried about the fact that the deity is not appearing very clearly initially. That will come over time. Of course, as Alan mentioned, I think just earlier today maybe even, that if we, of course, have the empowerment, if we did the empowerment at the beginning of this retreat, then doing the sadhana, of course, then we can arise as late-born Vajra. If we didn't receive the empowerment, then if we want to do some sort of deity practice, then as Alan mentioned this morning, we can do a little practice of simply arising as Chenrezig or Avalokiteshvara. This is a public dharma, so we don't need an empowerment for this. Although, of course, it would even be good to have an empowerment, but not necessary. We can recite the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra. And if we don't have any, either the empowerment or we don't really even have any connection with the deity, then what Alan was mentioning is that what can be very good as part of moving into Dzogchen practice is to, again, dissolve into emptiness and then arise in your normal form, but not as this solid me body, but a body of light, this sort of rainbow body. So if we can arise in this way, that can help to stop grasping onto this body as me. So that's another possibility. So they were the three questions from this week. So hope you got something out of those answers, and hope to see you then next week.